Hello, this is Richard Davis, welcoming you to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not so old. This edition is unusual in that we have four items in it, each of which is presented by a different member of our production team. So hopefully you won't get too fed up by hearing my voice all the time. To start off with, Maya Davis will be telling us about Hedgehog Awareness Week, which, if you're listening to this programme in the first week of May, is actually this week. Then Chris English will be talking to our resident GP, Dr. Zoe Williams, about a new campaign to try to persuade people to have the COVID injections. I'll then be finding out about a project called Ambassadogs, which is being launched by the Sue Ryder organisation. And Chris Seymour will be finishing the programme by finding out about a Portuguese language course which is being run by the University of the Third Age. As usual, we'll be giving out various email addresses, website addresses and telephone numbers during the course of the programme, so you might like to have a pencil and paper handy to write them down. So, let's get started straight away. Here's Maya Davis.
Well, if you're a Brighton regular, you will think in terms of BHPS, being Brighton and Hove Philharmonic Society. But in fact, that's not the only thing. BHPS also stands for British Hedgehog Preservation Society. And here to tell us a little bit more about it is Hugh Warwick. Hugh, tell us about your relationship with hedgehogs.
My relationship with hedgehogs. Well, that's quite a long story. I've been studying hedgehogs as an ecologist since the mid-1980s, but of late I have drifted away to writing about hedgehogs and campaigning about hedgehogs and helping other people do research about hedgehogs. My first ever paid bit of writing for anything was a feature in the BBC Wildlife magazine back in 1993, 28 years ago, writing about hedgehogs. Some people's lives change dramatically as they progress, and other people's stay remarkably similar. I think I fall into the latter part of that.
I see. So you've really been tied up with hedgehogs for a very, very long time. And we're now coming up to Hedgehog Awareness Week, aren't we, which is right at the beginning of May. Why do we need a Hedgehog Awareness Week?
The reason we need to do it is, still, after all the years I've spent working with hedgehogs, I am surprised at the lack of fundamental understanding about some of the problems that hedgehogs face, in particular population decline, which we've measured through pretty robust, statistically significant science now since the turn of the century, so just in the last 20 or so years. And we know that the urban population is down by about a third in that time, and the rural population is down by a half. And that possibly the population for the entire country is down by between 90 and 95% since the end of the Second World War. Now, I mean, this is something which is based on the fact I do hundreds of talks to Women's Institute groups and University of Third Age groups and Probus groups and everybody who'll pay me and give me cake. And it's a great chance to actually find from people who are more mature than myself what their views are about what they remember when they were children, about how often they would see hedgehogs, and then get them to think about what they're doing now. And it's very rare you'll find somebody who is seeing more hedgehogs now than they did when they were a child.
So are they now on the red list of endangered species? Have I got that right?
Yes, that was last year. For some time, they probably warranted being on this rather infamous list, but there wasn't enough data. And the Mammal Society, who put this all together for the international group, the IUCN, they can't just on a whim say, we'll stick you on the red list. It has to be done properly. And now more data is in, and it's an unfortunate badge for us to be able to pin to ourselves.
Why are hedgehogs important?
Why are hedgehogs important now? Are we drifting into that hideous anthropocentric view of conservation where things really don't count unless they pay us? I get a little grumpy when it goes that direction. The hedgehog is not like the bee. The wonderful solitary bees which go around pollinating everything for us, and without the bees we'll lose a lot of our fruit. And they're not an ecosystem engineer like the beaver. But I disagree with the entire sort of idea of trying to measure value in terms of the benefits to us. There is a fairly fundamental right to life, And it's something which I think we really do need to consider. The hedgehogs have got every much as right to be alive as a badger, a bee, or a human being. We have to be very careful about this whole concept of human exceptionalism. I think it's something which we really, really, really need to avoid, because it then separates ourselves off from the natural world and gives us an excuse not to really do anything. They're really important because they're part of our wonderful ecosystem. They're part of our garden ecosystem, our suburban ecosystem. They're a species we can actually have contact with. They're a species without a fight or flight response. So, I mean, hedgehogs covered in prickles. If they're frightened, they roll up into a ball. They don't run away. They don't attack you. It means if you're very quiet and you found one in the garden, you can very quietly sit there and wait for it to unroll, and it will unroll, and you can get to see this amazing creature, you know, reasonably close too. And that is the reason why the hedgehog is so important, because it gives us a moment of connection with nature, which no other species really allows us to have.
At the moment, you're trying to develop something called Hedgehog Street, which has got something to do with gardens. Can you tell me about that?
Okay, this is an indication of a great failing on our part if it's something we're trying to develop. The Hedgehog Street Campaign, which is a collaboration between the British Hedgehog Preservation Society and the People's Trust for Endangered Species, was launched 10 years ago. In fact, we are celebrating our 10th birthday this year. And the idea is very simple. If you look at a little hedgehog and you think, well, it's not going to need very much of an area to be able to thrive, you are mistaken. We've radio-tracked and followed hedgehogs. You know, they can do 2 kilometres a night easily. And if you start to do some clever statistics, you begin to work out what the minimum requirements are for a viable population of hedgehogs. And we know that a minimum starting population, it's about 30 hedgehogs, need 90 hectares, nearly a square kilometre of habitat. And this is at the heart of our problem. The average garden is 0.018 hectares. You know, we need 90 hectares. So we need a lot of gardens joined up to allow hedgehogs to be able to move through the landscape freely. And that's the idea of Hedgehog Street, is that your garden's not big enough. So you make your garden hedgehog friendly. You go to the Hedgehog Street website, you sign up, you do all of the top 10 tips on there about making sure you get rid of the hazards, making sure that you do all the good things, have compost heaps and log piles and bramble patches, etc. But the most important bit is you talk to your neighbours and you make a hole in the fence. Because they're wonderful hedgehogs, but they have yet to evolve the capacity to fly. And until they have done that, they need every bit of help getting between our gardens. So the really most basic bit of the Hedgehog Street campaign is getting people to talk to their neighbours and open up the gardens so that little hedgehogs can move all the way between them. Also, I mean, you're not just doing good for hedgehogs. And this is why a hedgehog is so important. They're important also because people love hedgehogs, because every time there's a vote or a poll, the hedgehog wins, the nation's nature icon, the favourite animal, the favourite mammal. We love hedgehogs in this country.
Now, people will occasionally find an injured hedgehog or a distressed hedgehog in their garden or in the street. What should they do with them?
Well, because the hedgehog has no fight or flight response, they are the most regularly taken into care creature. People would be much less likely to go to the rescue of an injured fox or swan. So the hedgehog will get picked up. And this is good in that injured hedgehogs can be returned to the wild and they will behave like normal hedgehogs. But it can be bad because sometimes people can act inappropriately and pick up unnecessarily. There are some fairly clear things, though. Hedgehogs are nocturnal. They come out at night. If you see a hedgehog which is sunbathing or looking a bit drunk out during the day, those are both signs that the hedgehog has got hypothermia and that it will die if it's not looked after. And so you intervene in those instances. If you see a hedgehog which is really covered in ticks, you know, one or two ticks, it's not a problem. Covered in ticks, that's a problem. If they have got lots of flies flying around them, if they, you know, smell really bad, sometimes you'll find a hedgehog which gets fly strike, which is one of the most hideous things. It may be a captured hedgehog, a hedgehog which has got itself tangled up in netting around a fruit bush or a tennis net, and it's out during the day and the flies will lay eggs on its face and on its softer parts, and then the eggs will hatch into maggots and start eating the hedgehog alive. These hedgehogs will die if they're not taken into care. So the first thing you do if you find a hedgehog which really needs to be looked after is you scoop it up in a towel, gardening gloves, something like that, and put it into a box. Now, this is important. You put it into a box and you put a lid on it, because even if it looks a bit feeble, it may try and escape. Put the lid on the box. If you've got the opportunity, you make it warm. So you create a hot water bottle with a 2-litre drinks bottle of warm water. You give it a towel or something to roll up in, jam jar lids of meaty pet food and some water. And then you call the British Hedgehog Preservation Society. Their website has got the contact details on there. and a phone number, and you phone that, and that becomes the portal. Even if it's during the middle of the night, you can find an answer phone which will direct you to your nearest hedgehog rescue. Either they will come and collect or you will deliver, and the hedgehog has a good fighting chance of being released back into the wild. Now, what you can do is preempt this, and you can get in touch with the British Hedgehog Preservation Society right now and say, I live here, where is my nearest hedgehog rescue? And just have that piece of information by the phone. And I will give you the phone number just in case. It's 01584 890 801. But they're easily searchable on the internet. Obviously, if you search for BHPS, you find things about horses as well as the Brighton and Hove Philharmonic Society, so British Hedgehog Preservation Society. People tend to dump stuff on my doorstep. I haven't the skills or the patience to do the enormous amount of work that's required to look after these animals, but I know people who do, so I will then deliver them on. Do wear gloves. I used to handle hedgehogs all the time barehanded because you get quite used to the pain. Gloves are becoming increasingly necessary because we're becoming more aware of the diseases that hedgehogs themselves can carry. They can pass on ringworm and other nasty. So it is worth picking them up with something. Even your partner's cardigan, you know, just whip it off them. If there's a hedgehog emergency, they can sacrifice that to a hot wash.
Fair enough. You mentioned hedgehogs carrying diseases. I assume that doesn't include things like COVID.
It's interesting you mentioned that. There was a absolutely scaremongering headline in the press a few months ago about how hedgehogs can carry COVID. This was a theoretical model which was undertaken, which looked at many, many hundreds of different species of mammal and concluded that it was possible that hedgehogs could carry COVID. The chances of anybody being shut in an enclosed space or engaging in smooching activity with a hedgehog are pretty low. And so even if a hedgehog could carry COVID, of which there is no evidence, it's particularly unlikely that they would transmit it. Unless, of course, you're doing inappropriate things with hedgehogs, which I think we need go no further.
We need go no further. So the bottom line is, don't give your hedgehog the kiss of life.
I would definitely argue against that, but not from a COVID perspective, just because they wake up and they go, what the hell is this? And then they'll bite whatever bit of you is closest to them.
And they've got very sharp teeth.
They're teeth which are designed for catching slugs and worms. So yes, they will nip. I've only been bitten once on my hand by a hedgehog, and somebody somewhere probably has a photograph.
And a recording of what you said?
Let's hope not.
Right, well, let's hope not. So that really covers quite a lot of ground then. We know about Hedgehog Awareness Week, 2nd to the 8th of May. We know that hedgehogs are endangered. We know a little bit now about the Hedgehog Street Campaign, the British Hedgehog Preservation Society, and how we can help hedgehogs. Could you just give me all those phone numbers again, the British Hedgehog Preservation Society and the website?
Let me go back to here. So the British Hedgehog Preservation Society phone number is 01584 890 801, and the website is britishhedgehogs.org.uk.
Hugh, thank you very much indeed for talking to us.
An absolute pleasure, Maya.
Maya Davis was talking to Hugh Warwick of the British Hedgehog Preservation Society. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to their website, which is britishhedgehogs.org.uk, or you can phone them on 01584 890 801. And now here's Chris English to introduce the next item.
A new campaign is just being launched to urge the public to get COVID-19 vaccine. Well, that's easier said than done, perhaps, you might say. Well, joining us, Dr. Zoe Williams, who is going to explain it all. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine. And tell me, another new campaign?
Yeah, so this is a campaign to launch the second phase of the government and the NHS vaccination programme. And this is really to target those under the age of 50. So as you know, all adults will become eligible for the vaccine according to their age. And the government's target is for everyone to have been offered their first vaccine by the end of July. So we're now getting to that stage where people in their 40s are being offered the vaccine. And as we go down the age groups, understandably, some people feel less inclined to come forward and get the vaccine. They perhaps feel like, you know, that they themselves are not as much at risk of COVID. But of course, there are many reasons to get vaccinated, primarily for people to protect themselves, but also to protect family and friends, and actually to protect the whole of the community. So this campaign is really just to remind everybody that every vaccination gives us hope. And that's the tagline of the campaign, and to encourage people to come forwards when they're asked.
I mean, it's a simple sounding campaign, but I've got a relative who's a serving police officer, but because he's only in his 30s, he's not eligible. But you think on the front line like he is, they would be at the top of the queue.
Yeah, I think there have been a lot of conversations throughout the vaccination campaign about whether people should have been made eligible sooner because of their job. Of course, police and anybody working in the emergency services have been deliberated. Teachers were talked about as well. Of course, really the only people who were prioritised are those working in healthcare and social care. And that's largely, I believe, because, you know, sadly, last year we did see such a significant number of people working in those professions who died from COVID. So I think you're right. I think there is certainly an argument that people working in certain professions are at higher risk of contracting the virus. But I think, you know, what there is hope now for those people who felt frustrated that they've had to wait when perhaps, you know, they felt that they were of higher need, that we're getting there. So, you know, within the next month or two, everybody should be offered their first vaccine, and people aged 44 are now eligible to come forward to get their jabs. So we're getting there. And I think, you know, there are people like the example you've given, who are sort of desperately waiting for their turn. But there are also people who perhaps don't feel it's that important for them to get their vaccine. So this campaign is really to target those people and remind them that, you know, every single person who takes up the vaccine, we're one step closer to getting lives back to normal.
I mean, you mentioned there the reluctance. I mean, there's quite a sizable group who say, no vaccine for me. Why do you think that is?
I think that there are a whole host of reasons. That there's a very small proportion of people who are very much against the vaccine. And, you know, I think often people who are very much against, there are some people who are against vaccines in general, and they're certainly not the target audience for this campaign. But there are lots of people, because the vaccine has come about quickly, and because of those initial concerns about, you know, well, how do we know that for definite it's going to be safe in the long run? I think there are a lot of people who were more hesitant. And I think for some people, particularly people from certain ethnic groups, particularly for younger people, I think they've almost had to just sort of sit back a bit and wait and see what happens and see it unravel before their own eyes. And, you know, now we're in a situation where 33.5 million people in this country have been vaccinated. And everybody, I guess, has now got that evidence, not just from the clinical trials, but from real life data. They've seen that this vaccination programme does work. The vaccine is safe. And, you know, thanks, you know, we're very grateful, I think, many of us in this country that we've had such a successful vaccination programme, because when we compare ourselves to other European countries who are similar to us where they haven't had such success, we can see how they're really struggling with such huge numbers. And I think it's fair to say that, of course, lockdown measures and the hand space and all of that makes a difference. The big thing that differentiates us from a lot of those other countries is the successful vaccination programme that we've had here.
And do you think that the situation in countries like India, for example, where the situation is horrendous, do you think that will make a difference?
It may well do. I think, you know, it's just heartbreaking when you see those scenes and you hear about what's happening in India. And as a doctor, you know, to think that there are people whose lives could be saved with something as simple as oxygen, but you don't have access to that. It's every doctor's worst nightmare to be in a position where you can save somebody's life, but you just don't have access to simple resources. I think, you know, it kind of, for some people, that comparison, it's hard to ignore the fact that we are so lucky that we live here in the UK, where we have such an incredible healthcare system, so that if you do get unwell with COVID, you're going to receive the best care, but also that we have things like the vaccination programme in place, which is the best protection, which is, you know, preventing people from getting COVID. I think there's a statistic that really, I think, is quite impactful, which tells us that in the most recent months, although close to 75,000 people have still been admitted to hospital with COVID-19, only 32 people who were vaccinated, who'd had their vaccine, you know, more than 3 weeks. We know it takes a few weeks to work. So such a small, tiny number of people who've become so unwell with COVID that they've needed hospitalisation, who've been vaccinated. So the evidence is there. The proof is there. We can't deny that these vaccines really do save lives. They are our best protection. And we're so lucky that we're in a country where we can all access a vaccine by the end of July, all of us, for free, if you're an adult.
Going back to this campaign, I gather there's a TV advert and a music song.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So the advert is a really positive advert. It's a good news advert, and it focuses largely on the thousands of people who've been behind the vaccination effort. So the doctors and nurses and vaccinators, but also the administrative staff who've had the huge logistical task of making this happen, the armed forces, and of course, you know, lots of people who've been coming forward and getting the vaccine. So it's a really positive, good news advert, which, you know, kind of just reminds us that this works, and, you know, every vaccine gives us hope, and we're in a position where we can be hopeful, we can move forwards, but it does depend upon people, you know, stepping forwards and rolling up their sleeve, is that what it says in the campaign, roll up your sleeve and get the vaccine when it's your time.
And sort of moving on to the future a bit, the NHS has obviously taken a huge battering in terms of backlog. How long do you think it will take things to get back to some semblance of order?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Chris. It's undeniable that the NHS has taken a huge battering. And in my experience as a GP, there are certain services that we just haven't been able to refer to over the past year, unless they're absolute emergencies. Things like physiotherapy, and, you know, people. So I have so many patients who are sort of struggling with musculoskeletal problems, for example, partly because there's a tendency for musculoskeletal problems to deteriorate when you're less active and less mobile, but also those services that we rely on, such as physio, that get people moving again. Physiotherapists have been required to be tied up on the COVID wards looking after COVID patients. So, and then we've heard about the stats around surgery as well, the huge backlog. It's gonna take some time. I think, you know, something that has been consistent throughout the past year is that emergency services have still been operating. If people have something that is a medical emergency, then you will still be seen quickly. It will still be dealt with. If somebody has symptoms that they think might be cancer, then, you know, they mustn't delay. We still have that 2-week wait system in process. So if you see your GP and your GP is concerned it possibly could be cancer, you'll still be seen or at least spoken to by a specialist team within 2 weeks. But the more routine procedures, which, when we say routine, you know, they're not life threatening, but they can cause misery for people who are suffering with pain related to their symptoms. There is going to be a huge backlog. We know for things like knee and hip replacements, depending on where you live in the country, it's not unusual to have a 6 to 12 month waiting list anyway. And those are going to be much longer. But, you know, we will catch up. And I guess we look towards the government to invest appropriately in the NHS and to try and, you know, do what they can. And I guess we look towards people who, one of the good news that's come out of this is apparently lots more people want to become nurses and doctors and physios and OTs and radiologists and radiographers. So hopefully over the next few years, we can bolster the NHS workforce as well. And that's going to be a really important step in helping things catch up. And hopefully in the future, we'll have a better, stronger NHS than we've ever had before.
Chris English was talking to Dr. Zoe Williams about the new campaign and the new advert, which you may already have seen on the TV. Sticking with the theme of health, but in this case mental health, I heard just recently that the Sue Ryder Foundation has just launched a campaign called Ambassadog, which aims to recruit 11 dogs as ambassadors for its hospices. The public are being invited to put forward their dogs as possible candidates in a competition which will close on the 28th of May. To find out more about it, I spoke to Tina Parkinson of the Sue Ryder Foundation and Matt Robinson from Pets as Therapy. And I began by asking Tina to tell me a little bit about Sue Ryder.
Sue Ryder has hospices and neurocentres across the UK which have patients with terminal illness, neurological conditions and brain injuries. I actually work in one of the hospices, Thorpe Hall in Peterborough, but they are all across the UK.
And the organisation's been going for quite some time, hasn't
it? Yeah, it has, yeah.
Now, you're running a campaign called Ambassadogs. Could you tell me something about it?
We're really, really excited that we've teamed up with Pets as Therapy to run the campaign to find our first ambassadog. We are looking for 11 dogs that could represent each hospice and neuro centre across the UK. This will be the first time we've done it, but because we benefit so much, all of us, from having therapy dogs in the hospices and the neuro centres, we felt that it would be a great time now to try and find an ambassadog for each of the Sue Ryder hospices and neuro centres.
So that's one dog per hospice or neuro centre,
yes,
is it?
That's right, yeah.
Is this a competition?
It is a competition, yes. We have an application form on our website. Anybody is welcome to enter if they have what they think could be the next ambassadog for our hospices and neuro centres. The date all the applications need to be in by is the 28th of May, and they'll be judged by a panel of celebrities, including Matt from Pets as Therapy here as well. He's one of the judges. They'll be looked at. They'll have certain criteria. They'll have a photograph of their dog on the application form. And then hopefully we'll get lots of applications and we have a lot of dogs to choose from.
And what do the dogs actually have to do?
Within the hospices, they would come in for a minimum of 2 hours a week, and they would support not only the patients, but the staff. They would sit with the patients with their volunteer aside them, fully trained. They bring so much to the hospice. Just to see a smile on a patient's face is an amazing, amazing thing. But I'm really excited about this because we have pat dogs in the hospice anyway, and I've seen what joy they bring to everybody.
And will the dog's owner be coming in with the dog?
Yes, the dog's owner comes in with the dog. The dog would go into the patient, and not only does the dog get satisfaction from being fussed and being fed treats, but the volunteer as well gets a chance to meet the patients and form a relationship with them.
I see. Are there any specific breeds of dog that are better at this work than others?
No, any breed is welcome to apply, from a little Chihuahua to the biggest Great Dane. It doesn't matter what breed, they just need to have the qualities that the judges are looking for to become the first ambassador for one of our hospices or neuro centres.
Turning to you, Matt, your organisation is known as Pets as Therapy. What does it actually do?
Pets as Therapy is another national charity. We were founded in 1983 by a lady called Leslie Scott Ordish. And basically, Leslie was really upset to see people that, for no fault of their own, could no longer have access to companion animal therapy. So she started taking her own dogs into care homes, and the charity's grown from there. So we've actually had a long relationship with Sue Ryder, in that our volunteer teams, which is comprised of a human, the pet's owner, and the actual pet themselves, of going into establishments like Sue Ryder Hospices. Pets as Therapy is a national charity. We operate in Northern Ireland, Scotland, England and Wales.
Presumably you have branches in various cities around the country.
No, we don't go down the branch route. We have a national head office based down in Oxfordshire. We have a team of, I think there's 9 of us at the moment, and we essentially have volunteers all over the country. And then we also have volunteer area coordinators in as many areas as we can actually recruit them into to help look after the volunteers in those places.
So is it only dogs that you use?
Pets as Therapy also has a few cats. I believe there's about 65 cats. The reason why we don't have as many cats is because any cat owners out there, they can probably appreciate, cats tend to be quite a lot more aloof. They generally don't like to travel, and they certainly don't like to be on leads or harnesses, which is a prerequisite for being a therapy animal with Pets as Therapy.
Why is there such a strong bond between dogs and people?
Really good question, Richard. There's obviously the old saying that dog is man's best friend. Now, there has to be something behind that. I think anyone that owns a dog, or should I say cares for a dog, appreciates the relationship between the two beings. So obviously the dog is given a caring environment, is provided with food and water. But in return, that animal provides companionship to the human element. It provides a listening ear without being judgmental. And of course, the wonderful benefits that come of that are that dogs reduce stress levels. They can listen to you, not pass judgment, not care what you're saying, and just allow you to kind of vent any frustrations you may have. And it's just that wonderful relationship between a human and an animal that can also help people in establishments where they normally wouldn't have access to a dog.
Is that why Sue Ryder are only using dogs in this scheme?
Yeah, I think Sue Ryder's already had experience with Pets as Therapy volunteers. As I said, you know, the relationship has been going for a while. So they've seen firsthand the benefits that our volunteers can actually bring to their patients. So it was a natural progression to reach out to us, I think, being the experts in the therapy animal world, to help them recruit these 11 ambassador dogs to help each of their establishments.
If people are interested in the work of Pets as Therapy, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, I think first and foremost, Richard, obviously this campaign is being led by Sue Ryder. So anyone interested in applying to become an ambassador dog needs to visit the Sue Ryder website, which is sueryder.org/ambassador dog, and on there they'll be able to read up a little bit more about the requirements, and of course they'll also be able to fill in an application form. And once that's completed, it will come to our celebrity judging panel, and I have the pleasure of sitting on that panel as well, along with Heidi Travis, the chief executive of Sue Ryder. We've got some fantastic celebrities lined up, including the actress Carly Stenson. We've got the presenter Kay Adams, TV presenter Richard Arnold, and the author of Everyone Died, So I Got a Dog, Emily Dean. And these guys are all dog lovers. So it's going to be a fantastic experience. I'm really excited to be involved.
But if people are interested in the work of Pets as Therapy itself rather than this particular scheme, how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, I mean, that's the great question. So we'd be delighted for anyone to read up about the work that we do and ultimately consider either registering as an establishment wanting a visit or indeed if you want to become a pet volunteer. You just need to visit our website, which is petsastherapy.org. You can complete application forms on there. There's our contact details if you've got any questions, and we'd be delighted if you get in touch.
I'm really excited about this competition, and anybody that thinks they have the right pet that could become the first ambassador for Sue Ryder, please, please apply.
It sounds like an excellent scheme, and I hope it's a great success. Tina and Matthew, thank you very much. I was talking to Tina Parkinson of Sue Ryder and Matthew Robinson of Petzer's Therapy about the new Ambassadog project, which Sue Ryder are running at the moment. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to their website, which is SueRyder.org/Ambassadog. Now, I'd better spell all that because there are some odd words there. Sue Ryder is spelt SueRyder. That's SueRyder, all one word. And Ambassadog is spelt AmbassadoG. That's AmbassadoG. To give you the full website address again, it's SueRyder.org/Ambassadog. If you don't have access to the internet, you can phone them on 0808 164 4572. That's 0808 164 4572. Now, with lockdown slowly coming to an end, some people are turning their attention to holidays. A popular destination for many is Portugal, but some older people may be worried about the Portuguese language. Well, help is at hand, with a group of older people who get together to learn the language. Presently, they meet via Zoom. Recently, Chris Seymour spoke to the group's leader, Jeff Phoenix, and asked him about the makeup of the group.
In fact, we're a mixed group, not only Brits who love Portugal, but Brits who've got property over there, and also a couple who are married to either Portuguese, or in both cases, one's the wife and one's the husband. And they've now got children, and they want their children to come up in a bilingual, with a bilingual ability.
What sort of level of Portuguese do you have to be to become a member of the group?
Well, you don't have to have any knowledge at all. We have complete beginners through to fairly advanced students. I say students, they're all aficionados, really. They love Portugal, they love the language, and they're doing it for fun, which is one of the important things we push in our group, that we're all doing this because we want to do it and we enjoy doing it. One of the things we believe in is that age is no barrier, whatever, to learning anything new, including languages.
Now, because of lockdown, it's been very difficult for your participants to meet, so you've been doing it on Zoom, I assume.
That's right. I mean, until April last year, we met actually in our house here in Stenning, and it had all been face-to-face. But as soon as the lockdown started last April, we decided that we'd have a go and seeing if we could do it on Zoom. And it proved to be extremely successful. Strangely enough, almost more successful than we had been before, because it meant those people who had to travel a distance found it easier to attend every meeting. Initially, we had members of the group who travelled 30 miles because there are so few opportunities to learn Portuguese in this country.
And how many members do you have at the moment?
About 20 altogether, 20 active members, and others who are either having a little time off for various reasons or they're busy with other things. But in total, I suppose we must have a membership of about 30 or 40 people altogether. But 20 or so who are actually learning every week.
Now, of course, there are two Portuguese languages. Which one do you teach?
I teach the European Portuguese rather than Brazilian. There is quite a difference between the two, and in particular in pronunciation. In Portugal, you say cidade, but in Brazil, you say cidade. Although it's spelled exactly the same, pronunciation is quite different. And, of course, there are different words, too. A train in Brazil is a train, whereas in Portugal, it's a comboio. So there is a slightly different vocabulary. But although European Portuguese is our favoured one, it's having problems at the moment, or has been, because of the fact that Brazilian Portuguese is spoken by, I think, about 180 million people, whereas in Portugal, mainland, there are only 10 or around 10 million people. So they are rather much in the minority.
Right. And of course, your Portuguese group is just a small part of the University of the Third Age. So tell us something about the University of the Third Age.
Well, it started in the late 70s, and it was invented in France and picked up very quickly by some far-sighted people in England. And basically, it's an institution where people who are retired or semi-retired have the opportunity of sharing their knowledge or learning something new with other people of a like mind and in their locality.
So what sort of things can you do?
Well, to give you an example, in Stenning, which is not a very big place, but we've got over 500 members with about 60 different interest groups. So there is Portuguese, I think there are four French groups, two Spanish groups, an Italian group, there's walking groups, bridge groups. I mean, it's you name it, U3A will do it if you're interested in either running the group or joining a group.
And now, as for your Portuguese group, you do have these various meetings when you invite people to come in and talk about various aspects of Portugal. What sort of meetings have you had in the past?
Right. Well, we're reading a book. The advanced group are reading a book called The Days on Which Portugal Was Happy, and it's like an almanac of events that have happened in the history of Portugal, going back to 1200 and so on up to the present day. When things happened which were of national importance and national pleasure to the population. One of the most famous, of course, is the 25th of April, 1974, when the revolution took place, the Carnation Revolution, when the previous dictatorship effectively was overthrown, as the country became a rather more democratic republic than was the case previously. And we're hoping to have a Portuguese national come and talk to us about it, this particular story. But in the book that we've been reading, it's full of shortish articles of about two or three pages. And we get a Portuguese lady to record them for us so we can hear them as a talking book, as well as reading them and translating them and then doing exercises on various things in the book. So if we come across a difficult word, we'll look for synonyms and antonyms and so on and make puzzles. It's make it a really interesting exercise to do. We have occasionally had Portuguese people and Brazilian people too, who live in the locality to come and talk to us about aspects of their lives that are different from English.
Of course, a lot of people going to Portugal just see the Algarve, but Portugal itself has a whole different life north of the Algarve Mountains.
Absolutely. A fabulously interesting country. Anybody interested in history, architecture, and the nature has got opportunities in abundance in Portugal. There are some wonderful buildings, many of international interest, international heritage sites, castles, cathedrals, monasteries, you've got a national park in the north, national park in the south. I mean, it's a delightful country, lots so much to see, more than just the sunshine and beach and the sand.
Now, I understand you spend quite a lot of time in Portugal yourself.
Yes, we've got an apartment in the Algarve near a town called Lagos. Lagos, it looks like in English. And we spend about 3 months of the year out there. Usually 5 or 6 weeks in this time of the year when it's pretty grotty here, and the same 5 or 6 weeks in the autumn, early winter, and then a couple of weeks probably in May or June, which is a lovely month out there, of course. But we like to be here in the summer, and our children and grandchildren enjoy being out there at the school holidays, so we keep out of the way then.
Why is it that Portugal and United Kingdom have this bond?
Well, we've had a long-term friendship with Portugal since about 1286, when the Treaty of Eternal Friendship was signed. John of Gaunt, everyone will know John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, married off his daughter to João the First, who was the first king of the whole of Portugal as we know it now. And João and Filipa of Lancaster, his wife, had several children, one of whom was particularly important, Henry the Navigator. So Henry the Navigator, whom the Portuguese are immensely proud, was of course half English. Now that treaty of eternal friendship has been renewed every 100 years, apart from on one occasion. More recently, I think the last one was in 1986, when I believe Prince Andrew was the one who signed the accord again. So we've had this long-term, very friendly relationship with Portugal.
Chris Seymour has been talking to Jeff Phoenix about the Portuguese language group that he runs through the University of the Third Age. If you'd like to find out more about the University of the Third Age, or U3A, as they're called for short, you can go to their website, which is www.u3a, and the three there is a figure three, it's not written out as a word, .org.uk. That's www.u3a.org.uk. And if you don't have access to a computer, you can phone them on 0208 466 6139. That's 0208 466 6139. And that phone line is manned Monday to Friday from 9:30 in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon. Well, that brings us to the end of our programme for this time. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard in this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, and that'll be presented by Chris English. And I'll be back with you in a month. Until we meet again, this is Richard Davis on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme for Radio Reverb, wishing you all the very best. Goodbye.